Kolasch, good morning to you. You may approach, and you may proceed.
Hey, please, court. My name is Keith Kolasch. I represent the appellant in this case, Ethan Ray, in a case that arises out of Nemaha County District Court. In that case, the district court considered on April 22nd, 2016, the Franks motion that was filed by the appellate in this case regarding whether or not there was a violation of the search warrant that was issued on August 23rd, 2015. And also as part of that hearing, the district court also heard a motion expressed by the appellant regarding evidence that was obtained as a result of somewhat ancillary to the original search warrant. In this case, the court did find that there was a violation of Franks versus Delaware. Specifically, they were looking at the information that was provided in the affidavit regarding the informant's credibility. Some of the information that was omitted included that Mr. Moore, who was the informant, was actually a jailhouse informant. That was not noted. At the time, Mr. Moore was still intoxicated with a blood alcohol content of approximately 0.195. He was also offered by the officer that was interviewing him, he was offered basically a deal on his DUI if he gives up information.
If the warrant has been declared invalid, it's not a violation of the warrant, it's whether the warrant was in fact valid, right?
The warrant was declared invalid.
Okay, so you have an invalid warrant that let them into the house.
Yes.
And they were searching somebody else's room and not searching the defendant's room.
Correct. Mr. Bray's room was specifically excluded from it.
And then because Bray walks into his bedroom and the officer accompanies him into the bedroom because it was alleged that they didn't want Bray to obtain a weapon or something, so they just walked with him. And they walked in there, Bray initiated the walk into the room.
He did.
And the officers followed him, and while the officer was in there, the officer observed some drug paraphernalia.
That's correct.
Okay, then after that, then the officer has a discussion with Bray as to whether or not he will consent to search his room because the officer says, I've seen drug paraphernalia in here, and I can apply and get a warrant, or I can apply for a warrant. Are you willing to consent? Isn't that the way this case goes?
Yes.
Okay. So is the real issue in here as to whether or not this consent was sufficiently attenuated from the invalid warrant search that occurred prior to the consent being given by Bray?
That is the concern. Obviously, one of the main issues that the district court brought up as far as finding if it was sufficient and attenuated was the intervening factors, which the main intervening factor that the court found was that the consent was voluntary by Mr. Bray.
Did Bray consent to the officer going into the room with him?
Well, the issue
is... Initially, when they first went in?
The initial officer that went into the room with him, I don't believe it was a voluntary consent. He consented for the officer to go into the room with him, but I don't think he understood that he was exposing himself to a search, a plain view search of his room.
So he thought the officer was just going to ignore the paraphernalia on the...
I believe that if Mr. Bray had known that was going to happen, he wouldn't have allowed him into the room. The search warrant, which Mr. Bray was provided a copy of and did read, he was informed that his room was specifically excluded from that warrant. So I believe he was under the impression that they aren't going to search his room. And unfortunately, I don't think it's addressed very much in physics classes or anything, but plain view doctrine isn't something that isn't necessarily well known. So I believe it was something of a pretext for the officer to say, well, we have to go with you because it's a safety issue.
Why do you think it was a pretext?
Mr. Bray was originally brought up with Mr. Moore in his jailhouse interview. He was brought up by Deputy Burris, who was the deputy that applied for the warrant in the first place. Mr. Moore had no information on Mr. Bray, but clearly the Sheriff's Department at least suspected Mr. Bray of some sort of wrongdoing, otherwise he would never have been brought up in that interview in the first place. So I think they get the warrant, get into the house, and if they get a chance, they can at least take a look in Mr. Bray's room and see if there's anything in there.
Did a second officer look into Bray's room?
The second officer looked into Bray's room and then also walked into Bray's room and had never asked permission to go into Bray's room. He made it in, I think by his testimony, about 4 feet or so into the room. Stopped. I think he realized, probably shouldn't be doing this. I need to get permission. He turns around and comes back out. And that's when that deputy and two other deputies take Bray outside and explain to him, look, I can get a search warrant, but I want your permission instead to search your room. I think at that point, if you look at everything that's been going on, he's been detained for about 45 minutes. They basically told him, you can't leave, you go into your room, you need an escort for our safety reasons, which of course there was nothing that was said by the informant or anyone else that would indicate that Mr. Gray was a safety issue. He had been detained for about 45 minutes. He was never searched. He was not acting unruly or in an aggressive manner in any way.
Did he call his lawyer before he ultimately consented?
He did call someone. From what I understand, he called his brother, which I don't believe was an attorney. I don't know what kind of advice he was given. From what I understand, he did actually call an attorney. But he did.
Well, he did request of the officer, can I call my attorney?
Did request that.
And then he got on the phone and he talked to somebody. And then after that, the officer asked him, are you willing to allow us to search your room without a warrant? Will you consent to that? And he said, yes. The officer then went to his car and got a written consent form, gave it to Bray to look at, and then Bray signed it. Is that right?
That is correct. I think you can also look at what Bray did after that, after he signed the consent. Mm-hmm. He did go into the room with them during the search, and you could see in the depositions that Mr. Bray was basically trying to control where they were searching. I don't think that it's a voluntary consent if he's still in there trying to control what areas they're looking
for. Well, so he could say, having signed the voluntary consent, can he revoke it at any time?
He could revoke.
Was there any indication that he ever revoked the consent to search? Okay, so what's the basic issue that decides this case?
The basic issue is whether or not he was under duress or if he was coerced into signing the voluntary consent. As I indicated, I don't believe the initial time when the trooper went in with him under safety reasons.
Didn't he, however, ask, I'd want to go into my room to get the... Where did you charge my phone, isn't it?
He did request to go into his room. I think it was explained to him. The way it was explained to him was that an officer has to accompany you for safety reasons. I think he was still under the impression that my room's not included in the search warrant, so he didn't go in with me, but he can't.
So his erroneous view, does that cloud his consent?
I think it does. To the point where the actual signed consent by Mr. Bray, he was confronted with the facts. They said he already had the trooper that went into his room. He'd been there and overheard conversations with the deputies and the troopers where they were specifically discussing what they'd seen in his room. He was entirely aware of what was in what the deputies had seen in his room. He knew there was at least one other deputy that went into his room and accompanied him. So when he's confronted with that information, the deputies say, we can get a search warrant, but we just want to ask. Just tell ourselves. I think at that point you can see that he felt he didn't have any choice. Basically, cat's out of the bag, everybody knows what's in there, and he's going to try and maybe get a little back door on them and try and control what they're looking at in the room to try and keep it just limited to those items that he's already been seeing. Which, of course, once they have, once they have a search room, they can search it.
Doesn't that suggest consent? The fact that he thought, hey, maybe I'm going to consent to this so I can get in there and have a little more control over the circumstance. Doesn't that weigh in favor of concluding that it was voluntary?
I think it goes more to he didn't understand what he was actually getting into when he signed the consent. The consent form obviously states that he searches room. He signs it, but then he still tries to control the situation.
Calculate decision, perhaps.
Perhaps, but again, it can't happen. it's just an engineer. He's confronted with all this information. Believes that I don't have any other choice. They're going to get a search warrant anyway.
But that's inconsistent with a calculated decision. I have no choice. It's not consistent with calculated decision.
I think when he's confronted with all that information, after he signs it, he is panicking a little bit. He needs to get not understanding that he could just revoke his consent. There's no further questions. I would just ask the court to uphold the decision of the district court regarding the Franks violation and ask the court to overrule the motion to suppress and have this filed back to district court.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Ralph, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. The overarching issue in this appeal is whether the district court properly properly denied Mr. Gray's motion to suppress. We submit that it did. In our view, Gray's consent was completely valid to search his room and his truck, and there were no grounds to suppress the evidence obtained from those searches.
Your position, however, is you would like us to address the portion of the ruling with respect to whether or not there was a Franks violation.
Yeah, I think, and as I set forth in my brief, I think the analytical framework for assessing the validity of his consent, which is the primary issue, depends on whether there was a Franks violation. If there was no Franks violation, then all we ask is, was the consent voluntary? If there was a Franks violation, as the district court concluded, then not only must it be voluntary, but it also has to be sufficiently attenuated, the consent from the preceding Fourth Amendment violation, illegal entry based on the Franks violation. So I think that's sort of the initial issue we have to address, and we disagree with the district court that there was a Franks violation. And we're not talking about the prototypical Franks situation where it's a false statement added into the affidavit that's the probable cause determination. We're talking about what this court termed in Tate v. Shuler, the quote-unquote reverse Frank situation, with omissions of information from the affidavit. And basically, if you recall, the affidavit rested almost basically entirely on one Devin Moore, an informant, offered information to the officer. And he basically said, he lived at the house, that he'd seen and smelled marijuana recently, that Gonzi or Salvis, Gonzi, had been using marijuana, and that based on the people that came by the house, he suspected he was selling it too. The alleged improperly omitted information basically went to the status of Moore, that he was not just some random guy, a citizen informant. He was in fact under arrest and in custody for DUI, drunk at the time, and he apparently was offering this information in hope of the leniency on the DUI charge. So,
what would that go to evaluation of whether or not she was a reliable informant?
Yes.
And was the court clearly wrong in determining that he wasn't a reliable informant and therefore the search was not valid or the warrant wasn't valid?
Well, yeah, I think the district court.
I mean, you have another theory to stand on, don't you?
Well.
Even if the warrant is invalid, you're claiming that the consent to search by the defendant was sufficiently attenuated from the actions of the officers in searching under the invalid warrant to sustain the validity of the consent to search his room and the drug paraphernalia that was found as a result.
Yes. We think there was sufficient attenuation, but if there was no Franks violation, you don't even get to attenuation analysis. So I thought it was a preliminary.
Well, how do we analyze the district court's determination that there was? Is that for abuse of discretion?
Well, no.
It's an evidentiary ruling, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. To get to a Franks violation, it comes down to an evaluation of probable cause. So you add in which would be a de novo determination under this court's case
and
law.
And it all goes to whether or not the evidence is admissible under the warrant.
Ultimately, yeah. So I think that the Eighth Circuit has set forth a pretty clear test. Basically, when we're talking about omissions, it says you got to show, the defendant has to show, one, that the facts were omitted with the intent to make or in reckless disregard of whether they make the affidavit misleading, and two, that the affidavit, if supplemented by the omitted information, no longer establishes probable cause. But our position is that, okay, you add in that stuff about the status of Moore, that he's under arrest at the time, drunk, and I forget the third one, but you add all that into what's already in the affidavit, and the tip is still reliable. For the reasons that I set forth in my brief, he's living there, he knows the guy, he knows the smell of weed, he gives detailed first-hand information. The officer is getting it from him in person, so it's he's able to assess his credibility. He's offering the information in the hope of getting a deal. Well, the only way you get a deal is if you give good information. And the fact that he was drunk, he was still clearly coherent enough to talk and speak intelligently. And as I said forth in my brief, when you're drunk, it's just as likely that you're more willing to tell the truth. So I think the reliability of the tip was still good, and there was still probable cause to issue the warrant, so there's no Franks violation.
Did the trial court rule on that, too, that even if this evidence was in the warrant, it still would be invalid?
Yeah. The district court found the warrant invalid, found a Franks violation. We disagree with that for those reasons. And I won't do much.
Counsel, shouldn't the district court evaluate the credibility at the time that it makes its decision on the warrant? So if it didn't have that information at that time, even though at the hearing this came out, this what you call credible information, is that really relevant to the judge's determination at the time of the warrant?
Well, no. At the time of the warrant, he's operating under, he doesn't have all the information. What the Franks analysis says is, okay, yeah, you made a mistake or reckless disregard, whatever, omitting that information from the probable cause affidavit, but for there to be a violation, now we consider everything together, and was there still probable cause to issue the warrant? If there was, then there's no problem, basically. There's no Franks violation. If there wasn't, then we say warrant's invalid, the evidence is excluded if it was basically as a result of that invalid warrant. So, yes, the district court, obviously can't make a decision on information not presented to it at the first time, but what Franks requires and what this court has said is, okay, knowing that, we add in that omitted information and then de novo determine if there was still probable cause. So our position is there's no Franks violation, so all you have to do is evaluate the voluntariness of the consent. And basically, I think it's pretty clear that the district court found that the consent was voluntary, and I think the record supports that determination. There was no issue with the first consent accompanying him into his bedroom. He asked to go in there. He wanted his cell phone charger. That's not unlawful coercion. It's not a coercion on the part of the state. And it's certainly within the officer's prerogative under well-established case law, Michigan v. Summers, U.S. Supreme Court, that the officers have a right to detain people while they execute a search warrant. I think this is just a logical extension of that right. He was not threatened. He was not misled into anything. The officer's statement that, hey, I can go apply for a warrant, this court has said State v. Tucker is not unlawful coercion. He read the search warrant, so he knew he was not a target, so there's no problem with the 45-minute detention. He knew he wasn't in trouble. He spoke, presumably with his lawyer. We don't know from the record who he spoke to on the phone, but right before he says, hey, can I call my lawyer first, the officer said, sure, and he spoke for 5 minutes on the phone with someone, and then consented. The written consent form that was given, he read it himself. It was read to him by the officer. And within that form, it clearly says, you do not have to consent. So in our view, it's clearly a voluntary consent. In the event that this court disagrees with me on the Franks issue, the attenuation analysis looks at the three factors this court set forth in State v. Gobra. And besides the sort of short interval of time between what would be the preceding Fourth Amendment violation and the consent, I think the other factors are clearly in our favor. Basically that the sufficient attenuation existed, unless there are any further questions.
Thank you very much. Is there any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day.